Barbara and I want to do something different. Not career-wise. Don't worry, the babes aren't leaving the airwaves. But we want to be a voice for some who feel their voices are rarely heard. So beginning today, we're dedicating every show this month to raise awareness around Alzheimer's. You'll hear from mothers, daughters, husbands, and wives about their angst, battles, tears, triumphs, and rare but worthwhile moments of laughter, all experienced while navigating their way through this mapless journey.
With over 5 million Americans touched by this crippling disease, we hope that our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, speaks to you with reassurance that you are not alone. To launch things off, I feel it's only right to introduce you to a personal side of me. Today, I want to tell you about my dad. His name is Mike Israel, and he has Alzheimer's. Dad and I can't carry on a conversation anymore, but he still loves his Frank Sinatra and his strawberry milkshakes. As the disease progresses, I hope some of our roughest moments are now behind us. For the past year and a half, he's lived in an Alzheimer's facility near me. I visit him often, and so does Kathy. So I've asked her to help me tell the story of my journey with my father, a man who was such a good dad, husband, and grandfather, and, whether he knows it or not, still is.
Perhaps the best way to get to know Mike is to start back in 1941, when he was a young man serving in World War II.
They gave him a camera and said, you were a photographer, but he was also in the infantry. So at the age of 18, he was in Germany, and he was in liberating concentration camps. And he documented it by photos as well.
Mike said very little about the terrible things he saw back then, even when his kids pressed him. But as a reminder of what he'd witnessed, he kept a photo of hundreds of bodies piled up in a heap like trash.
And he always carried that behind all his credit cards in his wallet. And I always thought it was a sort of juxtaposition. Here's a sweet, gentle, kind soul that carries this thing around. But it's so he would never forget.
Home from war and eventually married with kids, Mike was a sure and steady soul.
Well, my dad was always the one that you would go to for advice. He was a great listener and was really a smart guy. And he had a way of processing things, and he was also very down to earth.
His role in the household was a traditional one. He was the provider.
My dad took care of all the finances. And my mom and I would go shopping. You know, I remember maybe I was 10 years old and she was buying me some clothes. And so she wrote a check for this. And I remember it was quite a large amount. I look at the ledger part of the checkbook and it's blank. There's no way to tell how much money is in the bank account. And I said, Mom, how can you write these checks? Like, how do you know that Dad has, you know, that there's enough money to even write these checks? And she looks at me and she goes, I have faith in your father. And that's kind of how it was.
But just as the photo in his wallet faded, Mike's abilities seemed to be fading, too. About 15 years ago, he started forgetting things, sort of not cluing in to what was happening around him. And then his wife, Sally, got really sick.
My mom was diagnosed with cancer, so we didn't pay as much attention to what was going on with my dad probably as we should have, because our focus was really on my mom.
But your mom really noticed.
My mom noticed. I mean, my dad was her rock, and he was the person that really had always taken care of everybody. And my dad really wasn't able to go to the doctor's appointments. He didn't really understand, you know, when the doctor would tell her about what was going on with her sickness. She really couldn't depend on my dad anymore, and here she was dying.
Sally and Mike were happily married for 55 years, and he was there when she passed away. In the back of Barb's mind, she noted how strange and unlike him it was that he did not cry.
After my mom passed away, I brought my dad here for a couple of weeks, and he was really, I don't know if he was in shock. I think he was very diminished at that point. They knew he couldn't stay by himself, you know, right afterwards, you know, at home. And I wanted him to have a completely different change of pace. And it was funny because we had these 2 weeks, which were kind of like healing for me, and it was healing for him. But he did not bring up my mom. I had to bring up my mom. And that was devastating.
To keep his mind off his wife's death, his days were filled with long walks in the park, trips into D.C. with his granddaughter, Katie, who was home from college. So sometimes Mike seemed okay.
As the 2 weeks went on, he would say to me, you know what, Barb? I feel like I'm waking up from a dream. You know, I really feel like I'm waking up. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe he was just, you know, so cognitively diminished because of my mom and he was so tired.
But Barb's hope gradually died as her dad continued on a roller coaster of memory loss.
You know, he didn't know how to put on a seatbelt. And the worst was he went around to the passenger seat when he should have gotten in the driver's seat. So that was definitely a big tip off.
The most blatant tip off occurred when Mike couldn't figure out where his old haunts were anymore. Places he'd loved to go for many years in Highland Park near Chicago.
My dad still wanted to be very independent. You know, he loved going to the library. He loved going to the botanical gardens. He loved driving.
Then one day he went on a routine little trip to the post office.
And he had backed into somebody and he didn't know it. And he drove home and the police appeared at the door. And they asked him what had happened, and he had no recollection of running into anybody or any car. And, of course, my dad was so honest, he would have admitted it if he realized it. And that's kind of when we realized, you know, he really should not be driving.
And with the car keys gone, isolation set in. As his fuzziness grew worse, his poker and tennis buddies drifted away.
Some of their friends were not solicitous, as I thought that they would be. It was very disappointing, actually, for all of us.
Barb's doting brother Larry, who lived nearby, was on call 24/7, and her brother Jim, like Barb, commuted from afar. But their dad needed more supervision, so a decision was made to keep him at home with caregivers.
He was at home for a couple of years, and for the most part, we had really good caretakers that really liked my dad. And my dad would call him this friend, and they would go do things. So my dad was still very physically active at that point.
During the day, things seemed to be okay. But during the midnight hours, hallucinations began to take over Mike's mind.
My dad would call us on the phone, and he would say, you know, Barb, there's Chinese people in my house. And I'm like, Dad, I don't think there's any Chinese people in your house. And he said, no, I know last night they came and they moved around all the things. They moved all the pictures around. And I know there were Chinese people. And I said, I was trying to make a joke out of it. Like, Dad, why Chinese people? Like, maybe they're Swedish, you know? But no, he was absolutely convinced. We thought, maybe you ate Chinese food. You know, we tried to make a joke out of the whole thing. But that's when we realized that something was really, really amiss.
Confused and sad. It was time for a talk.
One day I was visiting and he said, you know, Barb, I want to move because I'm really lonely here. And we thought, hallelujah, you know, this is fabulous. You know, we don't have to tell him that he's got to move somewhere.
This was a lot of insight from a guy who was fighting hard against a bad problem, a creeping illness called primary progressive aphasia, a form of dementia.
You lose your ability to communicate, to express yourself. So there's all that language part. There's a language of writing, there's a language of reading, and there's a language of speaking.
The brain is a giant filing system, but Mike couldn't put the right words together to make sense.
But we never thought it would get to the point where he literally could not communicate.
It did.
When we realized that he couldn't no longer stay at home, there was this very good facility that was for early Alzheimer's. And we knew people that had gone there and, you know, everybody seemed very nice. And, you know, of course, I got very friendly with the staff.
She had to. Mike was losing his ability to communicate. So the roles had switched. Barb and her brothers had to be their father's voice.
So it's kind of haunting because you don't really know how much there is going on that he just can't express. And also you worry about abuse, because like a little kid, if they can't tell you what's going on, you won't know. You really have to keep your eyes open.
And was there a time that you worried about that?
Yes. There happened to be this new aide I noticed that my dad really did not like. He didn't say anything, but he just sort of glared at her. So one night, I call my dad every night to say goodnight and to talk to him a little bit. And mostly it was me talking to him. He really couldn't speak back. But anyway, after I said goodnight to him, I realized that they didn't hang up the phone.
And suddenly, the reason why Mike glared was all too clear.
And there were some aides in the room, and they were barking orders at my dad. Take off your shirt. Sit down. Take off your socks. And it was absolutely devastating to me because, you know, here is this place on the surface seemed fabulous. But really, what was happening at night was so scary.
Barb and her brothers took swift action and the aide was fired. But after another really bad experience somewhere else, the siblings finally said enough is enough and moved their dad near Barb in Virginia.
I don't think I'm as upset now that my dad's here because I get to be with him. And I really do know what's going on all the time. I'm like a PTA mother, you know? I'm like a helicopter parent, you know, for my dad.
Mike has advanced Alzheimer's now, but physically, he's doing very well.
My dad's had bladder infections or even sepsis that should have killed him, but he's bounced back. And, you know, it's almost like the stock market. It goes up and then it goes down and maybe it goes up a little bit less. But it's so unpredictable. And here is my dad that's 90 years old. And who knows, you know, he could have a lot of years left because he's very, very healthy. So I would basically say you got to sort of sit back, relax. I wouldn't say enjoy the ride, but go with the ride. Because the more you try to fight against it, the more frustrating and, you know, really heart-wrenching it is.
As self-protection, Barb has tried not to shed too many tears.
It's almost like I'm fighting my way through this. I get mad, or I laugh. I do laugh quite a bit, but I do also get mad. I mean, I've had my share of tears, but at this point, you know, it is what it is.
Barb has accepted that her dad probably doesn't know she's his daughter anymore.
But I do have to say, once in a while, I see these glimmers in his eye, like there's this pure love coming out of him. And I know that he knows that he loves me. I know when I go to see him, there's a smile that only I can give him. There's a certain smile that he gives me. It doesn't happen all the time, but believe me, it's worth it when it happens. It's wonderful.
Coming up next week, three women from the same facility as Barb's dad share their stories on how Alzheimer's and dementia has touched their lives.
We're like the Fabulous Five, and we laugh and we really share our angst. I really think these people, even after maybe our parents or our spouses, you know, do succumb to Alzheimer's, I really think that there's a bond that's going to last a lifetime.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless he loves you. All the way.
Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m. I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Thanks for joining us for this week's installment of Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's. Barb shared a personal testament of how Alzheimer's has touched her life by way of her dad, Mike.
Today, we'll hear from some of my gals, Audrey, Millie Jr., and Olivia. I spend a lot of time with these ladies on the third floor, which is the Alzheimer's section of the assisted living facility that houses our loved ones. My friends have welcomed us into their homes to add to the Alzheimer's discussion and to help us raise awareness of this debilitating disease for Alzheimer's Awareness Month. I'd like to start off by introducing you to Audrey. My dad shares a suite with her dad, Meyer.
He was a nuclear chemist and was very proud of the fact that he majored in biology and chemistry, and he worked for the Navy Department as a civilian.
My dad was stationed in Germany during World War II, so they probably have lots to chat about. But now they coexist in forgetfulness, family men whose wives died before they themselves began to fail. Like my dad,
Meyer's decline made it impossible for him to be taken care of at home.
I moved my father out of the house in New Hampshire because it was so clear he could not stay there, you know, alone. There were just cognitive issues and more like behavioral and emotional changes. Like there would be moments when he would yell at me about something and, you know, rather than give like a young child a time out, like I needed the time out and I just had to get out.
Alzheimer's has a tendency to cause behavioral changes, but sometimes, like in Millie Sr.'s case, it's for the better, according to her daughter, Millie Jr.
Well, she was quite different than she is now. My mom affected my relationships, especially with my husband, before she had Alzheimer's. My mom, you know, she was very overbearing and protective and intrusive and all the things that a mom can be. Sometimes I used to say, you know, Mom, you're not a Jewish mother. But she adores my husband now.
She forgot she didn't like him.
Exactly.
But you've got to cut Millie Sr. some slack for her past possessiveness.
My sister was killed in an automobile accident when I was 8 and she was 11. My mother was driving. It was very traumatic. My father was in the passenger seat. And none of us were really hurt beyond bumps and bruises, but my sister died on the scene. So, of course, Mom and Dad and my grandparents became extremely protective of me.
Now Millie Jr. is the protective one. She does all the little things that once mattered so very much to her mother.
Mom always was very meticulous about the way she dressed. She always dressed very stylishly. She didn't want to dress like an old lady. When she moved there, I didn't bring a lot of her clothes that I thought were impractical. She likes to have a hand in it, and she helps dress herself. So,
she still gets joy from dressing
she,
well.
Likes things. And one day when I came there and she had this ridiculous combination, I'm not sure who got her dressed. I said, Mom, are you okay with what you have on? And she goes, no, this is ridiculous. Let's go change. So, you know, wow. She can have her lucid moments.
Knowing that her mom still cares about her appearance helps Millie Jr. grasp a piece of who her mother used to be.
You want to hold on to an image you have of your mom, and you want to have some part of her be a little bit like she always was.
For Audrey, preserving her dad's dignity means honoring his food choices.
You know, because my father kept kosher his whole life, I really, you know, work hard to make sure that they don't give him what I consider obviously non-kosher, you know, products. And you would think that would be easy, but even that isn't. And so it's, you know, kind of controlling the little things.
But sometimes things are out of your control. As a caregiver, it's hard to be on call 24/7.
Just the other day, he was sleeping at lunchtime, and the staff reassured me, oh, we'll make sure, you know, if he gets up and he's hungry, that he has something to eat. And I went back at 4 o'clock, and no one knew really if he had eaten. And then they said, oh, well, we asked him, and he said no. And I thought to myself, I don't fully believe that. And I followed up the next day with the head care manager. And I said, what's so disturbing to me is, as we all know, these people, they can't speak for themselves. They cannot. And I said, I don't believe that he wasn't hungry. I believe that they asked him, but I don't believe that he wasn't hungry. If someone handed him a half a tuna fish sandwich, he would have eaten the sandwich.
Mealtime is important to Olivia, too. Every night, like many people who have Alzheimer's, her husband, Ralph, begins to feel anxious and slides into that gray, emotionally fragile slump called sundowning.
I have a date with him every night. You know, he remembers that you don't start until everyone at the table has their food. So I bring a little tub of yogurt and some little munchies with me so that I can eat while he's eating. So I try to be there for him to make it an easy transition from the day to the evening. And after supper, we listen to jazz because we both love music, and then he gets very sleepy.
Olivia often plays Ralph's favorite tune, a little Benny Goodman number called Sing, Sing, Sing. It's a merry end to the evening, but so different from the good times they shared when they played bridge, the game that jump-started their relationship many years ago at a friend's house.
When Ralph walked in, a lightning bolt, and I thought, good grief, who is this guy? And we started to play. He's an excellent bridge player, which was very impressive. once, several months ago, I said, what's your name? And he said, I don't know. So I said, what's my name? He said, I don't know. I said, well, I'm Olivia. He said, oh, yes, and I'm Ralph. The loneliness, I think, I notice at night. So at night, I decided that I'd learn how to play jazz piano.
Oh, that's great!
Which is fun.
Ever the realist, Olivia tries to put things in perspective.
It's just a tragedy that they can't seem to find some way of dealing with this terrible brain disease.
The bottom line is a crappy disease.
There are others that are a lot worse. Ralph's sister was married to a very successful surgeon, and he had Lewy body Parkinson's, which is dreadful. Mm-hmm. And his brother had ALS. But Alzheimer's, you watch the very, very slow deterioration of a human being. The dissembling, the taking apart, it's so slow. It's a very, very ugly disease.
Olivia remains up for the challenge. You see, through it all, Ralph continues to be her rock. But she'll be the first to admit that taking over his load has been a daunting task.
As far as taking care of him, that was easy. But to assume the responsibilities that he had is really a very big change. Very big change. And I'm still dealing with that. It's difficult. It's very difficult.
Sometimes the role of a caregiver can feel like a burden too heavy to bear, while other times the experience can be a blessing in disguise.
You know, it's been such a process, and it's been a process for 4 years. I don't know if I sacrificed because I think I've gained from it.
Yeah.
I think you've probably showed your children what a wonderful, you know, person you are and how important it is to care for your father and their grandfather. And
I think that's right. The goal.
Okay. So let me ask you, if somehow there is a magic potion and your dad was able to become lucid for 2 minutes and you were able to ask your dad, do you want to live this way? What do you think would be his response?
It's really hard because as a person with healthcare power of attorney and having to make all kinds of healthcare decisions, I'm always questioning whether or not I really know. My dad always wanted to live. Like, whatever. You know, he didn't want to die. He wanted to live. That said, I don't think he ever thought his end would be like this.
Perhaps caretakers should try not to worry about the inevitable.
The best advice I ever got when I moved Mom where she is now is from the head of their assisted living department. He's wonderful. And he said to me, go with the journey. And that phrase resonated with my husband and myself. So if Mom says, Bill is coming, so when you leave, he likes to leave us alone to visit.
And that's your dad?
Bill is my dad, yeah. Yes.
Oh.
And he'll be here. And my response to her is, okay, Mom, great. All right. Well, I'm sure he will. Or if she resists going downstairs to the porch, Bill is coming and he won't know where I am. I said, I'm going to leave word. He'll know where to find you.
Oh, wow.
So you really have to become quite the fibber.
Yes.
And you have to just go with the journey.
Millie's bad days come when she experiences the rawness of her husband Bill's death all over again.
First time my mom insisted my dad was right there, it made me really sad because they really had a love affair. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it made me happy because it made her happy.
As a caretaker, we often fight back tears with humor.
I think I could laugh and cry at the same time. I mean, there are moments when I've gone to see my dad. I just see him like more tired, more worn out. And I feel like very sad because he looks sad. And then other times, you know, at the same moment of feeling sad, I'm like, okay, Dad, so which of the seven dwarfs are you today? Like grumpy or happy or sleepy or snoozy or sneezy, you know, like the whole rundown. He could be any and all of them, you know, and I do like a running monologue as a way of almost like amusing myself and relieving the stress.
Then we sometimes have those rare but worthwhile moments of pure laughter.
There was a resident who was really kind of the house curmudgeon, the grump. He was big on yelling, and He ended up somehow at mom's table. And he must have had dry skin because he kept saying, scratch my back.
And I mean, was
at the top of his lungs.
So Millie's mom did just that.
And she was scratching and he goes, oh, I think I love you. And she says, oh, I love you too, because mother is big on loving everybody. And he says, well, if you love me, then you're going to have to sleep with me.
And he had a huge smile on his face.
Don't forget the
happiest
big grin.
I've ever seen him.
Yeah, and this guy never grinned, never laughed. And another resident who can be very outspoken and kind of quick-witted, even, you know, for her, she goes, please, please, this is a Catholic church. it's kind of like, you know, who's on first and where are we? You know, there's so many stories that Barb and I have experienced that you've got to write them down or you'll forget them because they're just so funny.
So as our loved ones drift in and out of their private realities, us caregivers have to learn to take the good with the bad and embrace these moments.
I'm just living in the moment. Right.
Carpe
now.
Diem, right?
Carpe diem. No, not carpe diem.
Que sera, sera? What
not
will be, will be.
Just live in the moment and take each day as it comes. Sufficient is the day and the evil thereof. I just think you have to wait until you are in a position to make plans. I just want to make this end of life for Ralph as smooth as is possible.
Next, we focus on caring for the caregiver. Did you know that there are over 43 million adult families caring for someone over the age of 50, according to the Alzheimer's Association? As we continue to explore the multitude of dimensions surrounding Alzheimer's, we felt it was imperative to address the role of the caregiver.
It's funny because initially, I didn't see myself as a caregiver. I was a mom, a wife, a daughter, but caregiver? No way. I was just looking after my dad. But I now know that there are nearly 15 million people just like me caring for someone with Alzheimer's or related dementias. If you find yourself checking to see if your loved one is taking their meds or going to their doctor's appointments or ensuring that they're eating nutritious meals, I've got news for you. You're a caregiver.
While some caretakers adapt to their roles with ease, it's good to know that there are skilled physicians ready and willing to offer guidance and support.
I think the main way we try to help caregivers is to, number one, really try to help them understand what it is they're facing. I can't tell you how many times caregivers who have been helping their parent or their husband or wife for several years will come with questions about what is this really that is happening. And we do spend a fair amount of time in helping caregivers understand what illness or illnesses are impacting their loved one. Because that knowledge, getting as firm as you can diagnosis and knowing what you're facing, really helps then shape the steps forward.
Dr. Rosemary Laird, at the grassroots level, specializes in the care and treatment of persons with Alzheimer's and related dementias. She's the founding medical director of the Health First Aging Institute, which also provides education and support programs for caregivers.
I have an outpatient clinic located in Merritt Island, Florida. Our clinic is designed slightly different from a typical doctor's office in that we have two rooms that serve as family conference rooms. We see both patients and their caregivers at the same time.
Dr. Laird is a firm believer in not only educating the patient, but also the caregiver.
We focus almost just as much time, we try, on the caregivers of our patients. Because while the patients are having the medical and other challenges that come with the illness, caregivers are alongside them working through some of their own challenges as caregivers, both in providing the care their loved one needs and trying to figure out a way to keep themselves going through this long journey.
Being a caregiver is far from easy, but with the proper tactics, we can remain the steady advocate our loved ones need.
We really try to help caregivers understand that this illness is a long one, and in order for them to be able to really withstand the chronic stress that this really does place on them as an individual, they have to take time to make sure that they remain healthy physically, they remain emotionally healthy and stable. And so our way of giving them a mantra is take your oxygen first.
Those four little words, take your oxygen first, not only serve as a mantra for caregivers, but they're also the title of a book co-authored by Dr. Laird. The book takes a more in-depth approach to explaining the significance and benefits of a caregiver taking charge of their own mental and physical well-being before attempting to care for their loved one. The best analogy that I can come up with to explain this would be, if you've ever been on an airplane, before takeoff, the flight attendant tells parents of infants and children to put their oxygen mask on before assisting their child. Though it may sound selfish or even unreasonable at first glance, if you can't breathe, how will you ever be able to assist your child? Well, as a caregiver, it's pretty much the same concept. Dr. Laird is also a huge advocate of establishing a team of supporters.
I spend a lot of time working with the caregivers on making their caregiving team, surrounding themselves with, number one, medical professionals who are understanding of their situation and knowledgeable of what their loved one needs. They really have to have that team over the course of the illness. Next, they need to have a team of either family members or friends and other professionals who are going to step in over the course of the illness. So as the disease progresses, you may need to call on different individuals. So putting together their caregiving team is one of the things that we talk to caregivers a lot about.
As caregivers navigate their way through this mapless journey, behavioral changes are almost impossible to avoid.
There are many different reasons why a patient with Alzheimer's disease may develop a certain behavior that becomes a problem.
Alzheimer's is not a linear disease, and neither are the behavioral changes. But Dr. Laird believes that while changes are bound to occur, it's important to keep things in perspective.
Understanding, number one, that it comes from the disease is important. Number two, figuring out if there's a specific trigger for that behavior becomes important. Then knowing that information, you can move forward and try to figure out how to fix it. Unfortunately, in the fast-paced world of modern medicine, sometimes the fixes are reached for too quickly are the medication fixes. The medication fixes tend to be sedative in nature, but that's a Band-Aid at best and a dangerous one. And it doesn't really get at the problem. Why that behavior started in the first place. We prefer to educate and try to turn that caregiver on to some ways without medication to try to avoid the problem or manage it.
It seems as though I'm always the doubter. So Dr. Laird shared a real-life example of how her formula works or has worked with an actual patient.
We had a situation in clinic earlier this week where a gentleman was becoming particularly upset right around mealtime and actually was kind of pounding his fist, and then most recently had thrown something at the caregiver who was simply trying to help give him a nice meal. And in the process of educating the family and caregivers, we explained how in some situations that kind of behavior and even a violent outburst behavior could be in part because the individual with Alzheimer's disease isn't able to communicate as well some situation. And for example, they may not be able to communicate what they do or don't want to eat, or that it is time that they want to eat, or it's not time that they want to be eating.
There are tons of caregivers unable to pack up their lives to move to be closer to their ailing loved one. But there are things long-distance caregivers can and should do.
Let's say you're miles away and you've just found out about a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. I recommend to family members that they start to become supportive observer of some critical areas that may get their loved one into trouble. So, for example, medication management, that's an area that can have medical implications quickly. financial management is an area that can have certainly drastic complications if not managed correctly. And distance caregivers can sometimes be very helpful just by asking about those activities and whether or not they seem to be going well.
Another idea for the remote caregiver is to
find out who the medical team is taking care of someone locally and talk to your loved one about allowing for you to be allowed to get information from their physician. And if possible, that's a good way to try to stay on top of when they might need additional support. The physician can sometimes tip you off to that.
As the holiday season nears, caregivers often struggle to find ways to include their ailing loved ones in their family activities.
We try to help our caregivers understand that for all of the challenges they're going to face, an overarching theme is to try to help their loved one be as successful as they can in any situation for the stage of illness that they're at. How you may help your father in year one of this illness may be very different from how you may handle things later. So a general theme is, what does your loved one do successfully right now? And how could you take advantage of that to figure out how you want to spend the holidays? So an example, if your father, you get report from the assisted living facility that he's not really participating too much in activities, but he's enjoying the music programs and he's still getting up and around and able to move pretty well, then you might think about having a family event where you all go to a restaurant, or you go to a familiar place, someone's home, where you know your father will be comfortable. But you might not have him scheduled to be at the big, fun, but raucous party where all the young grandchildren are. You may have more success by knowing that at this stage, these are his strengths, and this is where we want to schedule things.
Maintaining a positive outlook and continuing to measure success specifically for where your loved one is right now is so very important.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Come on, smile.
Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy.
Or maybe he's teething.
Maybe it's just a phase.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No big, joyful smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Alzheimer's steals memories, and not just from the patient. This disease can rob the very essence of who an individual is, even from those that love them.
Unless, of course, you do something about it. The two men you'll meet today, Barry Peterson and Bill Schreiner, have preserved the true being of their loved ones through writing and on camera. Barry talked openly about his life and wonderful wife Jan on CBS Sunday Morning and what she was like before she became deathly ill.
Jan and I were married in 1985. CBS posted us to Tokyo and Moscow, on to London and back to Asia. One of the things I loved most about her was how she embraced each new city as a new adventure.
3 years ago, Emmy Award-winning correspondent Barry Peterson produced a television segment about his wife's struggles with early-onset Alzheimer's. Prior to that, he documented her journey in a book appropriately titled Jan's Story.
It started because I didn't think Jan's life should be forgotten. You know, she was a very special, unusual person. She was perhaps the greatest example of a person that I know who woke up happy every day. Life was good for her. She liked it. She loved it. She loved our life. And, you know, I sat down and started writing this because really I wanted to hand it to my children or my grandchildren and say, this is the person that you missed knowing.
While Barry and Jan were breaking news, Dr. George Schreiner was making news. George's son, Bill Schreiner.
He worked with some of the great people who did the research that led to the first kidney transplants and artificial kidneys.
And you know that organ donation checkoff on the back of your driver's license? Dr. George Schreiner is responsible for that, as well as other huge contributions.
He was one of the people that got dialysis approved as an ongoing Medicare expense that you could get.
So when his dad's memory started failing, Bill gave him a present he'd really appreciate.
I hired a writer to spend 100 hours taping with him so that he could get the story of his life down on a piece of paper. I felt my dad psychically relaxed. I think he felt, instead of feeling like his life was literally evaporating and was going to therefore not have any meaning, I think my dad felt that his narrative had been put down on paper, that others were going to be able to read it generations later. And so that meant that his life wasn't really going to evaporate. It wasn't really going to turn into nothing.
It's a good thing Bill captured his dad's story when he did. You see, Bill was missing some of the early warning signs of Alzheimer's. His dad was no longer just forgetting words or phrases. He began making uncharacteristically risky investments and went from completely organized to disorganized.
Overseas, first in London and later in Asia, Barry Peterson was also naive to Jan's behavioral changes.
Well, let's first start by saying Barry was an idiot. So I practice what a lot of people practice, which is denial. I didn't want to see the symptoms of Jan's forgetfulness, how she'd repeat sentences, all kinds of excuses. One time, one of my daughters, her stepdaughter, said, you know, Dad, she's repeating all these sentences. And I said, oh, I'm sure it's the weather. There must be a front going through, and it's got her ears clogged up.
Like many people with Alzheimer's, Jan had figured out ways to compensate.
We'd go to a restaurant, and she'd look at the menu like we all do, and she would say things like, what did we have the last time? Well, we really liked the fish thing. That sounds good to me. Mm-hmm. Took me a long time. I didn't even know how long. Before I realized she was doing this to cover the fact that the words on the page no longer made sense to her.
But gradually, those everyday cues that someone with memory loss might rely on, they weren't enough. Bill Schreiner.
We didn't pay too much of attention to it until he disappeared one day. Literally went to see my mom, who at that point was in a nursing home in Fairfax, Virginia. This is a place where he had visited many times, and he failed to make it home.
And Bill Schreiner's frightening search began.
We got a hold of the police. We tried to track his credit card transactions and everything we could to figure out where he was.
How long was he missing?
He was missing 2 days.
Then finally, he turned up miles away in West Virginia.
He thought my little sister, who was now a grown woman with children of her own, had failed to reemerge from a dance class that he had dropped her off to. And he went to the police to say that his daughter was missing. So he turned himself in.
The doctor suspected Alzheimer's, which led to some very unnerving tests for George.
He went into a two-day isolation, and they do that to take the context away so that they don't have cues. My dad was a brilliant guy. We didn't realize the degree to which he was adapting to what was happening. Yes.
Prior to being isolated, George would read the newspaper to figure out what month it was or for any other contextual reference. But now, with those reference points gone, George was confused. So Bill hired home caregivers and followed his doctor's advice.
The doctor explained to me, look, your dad lives in a home that he's very proud of. It's kind of a little farm. It has a lake. Your dad needs to wake up, look out the window, see the lake, and all of this will bring back to him who he is. Don't take that away from him. You know, let him have that.
As long as he can.
Right. Yeah.
And there was a moment in time, several years later, I took him out to lunch, brought him back to that house that was very unique to him. And he turned to me and he said, where is this place that you've taken me? It didn't mean anything anymore to him.
At that point, Bill knew it was time to move his dad into an assisted living facility.
Barry tried keeping Jan at home, too. That didn't work out for long.
I thought having a live-in caregiver would buy me 2 more years of living overseas with Jan. It bought me exactly 8 months. And the reason, which is really hard to tell you about, is the lady who was the caregiver sat down with me and said, 8 months, it's time to think about assisted living. And I said, well, I don't think Jan's that bad. And she said, it's not Jan. It's you.
It's you. Oh.
You're going down. And you have to really think, if something happens to you, who's going to take care of Jan? And the logic was impeccable, but the emotion was overwhelming. And ultimately, I listened, and we put Jan in a facility. And I got, you know, the first good night's sleep in 5 years.
Early onset Alzheimer's is especially vicious. As he watched his vibrant 55-year-old wife lose all sense of herself and him, Barry knew they'd have a long, hard haul.
Alzheimer's really wants two people. Wants the person with the disease, and it's going to take down the person who's caring for the person with the disease. And it will go for as long as it takes.
Just as Jan had once embraced life with joy, Barry reached out too. He knew she'd want him to, so he listed himself on Match.com.
My status was separated, and I would immediately say separated, but not by lack of love, but because of Alzheimer's. I was very upfront about it.
And he found a woman named Mary Nell.
And it didn't bother her. She had gone through the loss of her husband in a bicycle accident. So I think she really recognized not just the way that I was, but the process of grief that I was going through. Because I grieve for Jan every day, because you lose a little more every day. And she understood that, and she embraced helping Jan.
Barry continued to visit his wife Jan often with Mary Nell.
And it seemed like we were helping, you know, we were connecting and kind of bringing her into the world. And then I would leave, and the next several days she'd be agitated and upset and angry. And we finally had to talk to the people at the facility. They actually wanted to talk to us, who said, your family, we're not going to tell you what to do, but we're not sure it's really a good idea to keep pulling her out of wherever she is, because it takes her days to settle back in. So after that, what we basically did was I'd sit in the office and watch her. And then my lady friend who helped me, Mary Nell, would go and talk to Jan, and that was okay. But I stayed away. I couldn't engage because, as amazing as it sounds, to hold her, to talk to her, and to bring her back would be worse than to just stand away and let her live in the world and what she was in. It was hard.
Mary and Barry both talked frankly about the complexity of their lives on the CBS Morning Show.
Mary Nell lost her husband of 22 years in an accident. We now live together. And before you judge us harshly...
This truly is a case of having to walk in someone's shoes before you make a judgment about how you would react and respond in similar circumstances.
Jan Charlton Peterson passed away this past May. She was 63. Peterson's loving book about his wife and their struggle with Alzheimer's is called Jan's Story, Love Lost to the Long Goodbye of Alzheimer's. The pictures in the book show many happy years of vibrant companionship.
Bill's dad, Dr. George Schreiner, is gone too. He died over a year ago at the age of 89 after battling Alzheimer's for over a decade.
Audio and technical guru,
he too left behind a family
magically
and a book of memories.
Webmaster Wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our like husbands, really daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way and give us great material, often without knowing it. Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners,
in closing,
for joining us,
we'll
share a passage from George's memoir titled A Life of Learning, the Dr. George E. Schreiner Story.
In collaboration with Zymer Communications.
As we now watch age take its toll on my father's cognitive skills, we feel blessed knowing that his amazing story will be there for generations of Schreiners to come.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit AARP.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.